This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Federal Police and Parliament Speaker are refusing to say why a prominent anti-Beijing activist was ordered to leave a public section of the building or risk facing arrest. Human rights campaigner Drew Pavlou was due to meet the head of Parliament's Intelligence Committee, but claims AFP officers told him he'd been deemed a high-risk individual before escorting him out. Andrew Green reports.
In Parliament's grand marble foyer, Drew Pavlou, an outspoken critic of human rights abuses inside China, is escorted out of the public entrance by federal police.
What have I done? This is a public area.
Yesterday morning, he'd met with Liberal Senator James Patterson to discuss what he describes as a pro-Beijing campaign of harassment towards him. At lunchtime, he dined in the building's public cafe ahead of another meeting scheduled for that evening with Labor MP Peter Carlile, the head of Parliament's powerful Intelligence Committee. There, he says he was approached by several AFP officers.
They just said, sorry, mate, we don't want to have to do this, but our higher-ups insist you have to leave now because you've been flagged as a high-risk individual.
In July, the 23-year-old was also detained by British police for over 20 hours, which he claims occurred after the Chinese embassy in London framed him with a hoax bomb threat.
Because of the way that I was targeted by the Chinese authorities and how they've tried to smear me as this kind of terrorist bomb threat guy, I go to my own Australian Parliament, our seat of democracy, and I'm not even allowed to be in the public gallery, sit down and have lunch without being accosted by Australian Federal Police.
Shortly after the incident, Labor's Peter Carlile appeared on the ABC's afternoon briefing program and was asked about what had occurred.
I haven't met with him yet, but I think this is really a matter for the presiding officers to determine what's going on. I think it's with them at the moment, the Speaker and the President, who have control of the security or preside over the security of the House and the Parliament and the Senate.
In a statement, a spokesperson for Parliamentary Speaker Milton Dick said the directive to remove Mr. Pavlou did not come from his office and was a matter for the AFP. The AFP has confirmed it engaged with a man who then left Parliament voluntarily but said it had no other comment to make. So at this stage, no one's explaining why Drew Pavlou was kicked out of the home of Australian democracy, but Peter Carlile says he'd still be happy to meet the activist in his parliamentary office.
I'm very open to meeting with him, as I am to many people that make requests to come and have a chat.
That's Peter Carlile, the chairman of Parliament's Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security, ending Andrew Green's report. For many people, crypto or cryptocurrency is a mystery. It's digital money protected by cryptography, which can be traded around the world online without a central bank or government backing it. Right now, thousands of Australians have been caught up in the recent collapse of one of the world's biggest crypto platforms, and they face the prospect of losing their savings and superannuation. FTX's downfall is creating havoc, and affected investors and consumer advocates say it's time to regulate the sector. John Daly reports.
Perth-based investor Adam always knew crypto was a risky business. Now he's learning the hard way just how risky. The online platform holding thousands of his dollars invested in crypto has frozen withdrawals, and he doesn't know if he'll get that money back.
Frustrated and annoyed. You know, even me with just a few $1,000, you know, felt a little bit sick in your stomach, but those people have tens of thousands of superannuation to them. It'd be horrible. You know, it sounds so cliche, but, you know, the mental health side of it, you have your superannuation worth hundreds of thousands tied up into a company that you don't know if is even going to be liquid in the next few weeks' time, would be horrifying.
Adam uses the Brisbane-based crypto exchange Digital Surge, which has been caught up in the collapse of FTX, one of the world's biggest crypto exchanges. Digital Surge assured Adam his deposit was secure. But in an email seen by the ABC, the company told users this may no longer be the case because the company has limited exposure to FTX.
It looks as if our funds or cryptocurrencies have been used in, I guess, inappropriate ways that were never secured, like they told us, at a one-to-one. That's my biggest issue. Answers. I think there's a lot of people out there who just want more answers than what there currently is.
The now bankrupt FTX is owned by tech mogul and so-called crypto king, Sam Bankman-Fried. Allegations Bankman-Fried misused the exchange to fund investments of another company he owns prompted investors to abandon FTX in droves. Lisa Wade is the CEO of digital investment firm DigitalX. She says the company sold off all of its FTX investments as soon as the story surfaced.
I don't like using the word luck. You know, looking as the guardian of our investors' money, we were lucky to sell before the tokens went to zero.
Quartermentha is now the administrator of FTX's Australian arms and is trying to get back the money owed to tens of thousands of Australian clients. Lisa Wade says the crypto sector urgently needs to be regulated in Australia. She says bad actors can't resist the world of crypto.
They're attracted to crypto like flies, right? Because they just see this honeypot of interest, and without regulation, you know, we're all susceptible to bad actors in the space.
Patrick Varay is the head of policy at consumer rights group Choice. He says the government needs to legislate consumer protections for the crypto sector.
It's really concerning that so many people right now have been affected by the collapse of FTX. I think it's incumbent on policymakers to find a solution and embed consumer protections, because right now the industry is largely unregulated. But the challenge for policymakers is providing a baseline level of consumer protections without giving a green light to this industry and kind of suggesting that it's a stable asset class or it's a safe investment. And that's a real concern.
Choice Head of Policy Patrick Varay. John Daly reporting there. After such heartbreak for the people of Cianjur in Indonesia, a small boy has been rescued after days trapped under the rubble of his flattened home. Though the death toll is likely to rise, with many people still missing, some remote devastated areas still unreachable, and more than 2,000 people injured in Monday's quake. Indonesia correspondent Anne Barker reports.
5-year-old Asghar was watching television in his bedroom with his mother when the earthquake hit on Monday. For 3 days and three nights, his family and neighbours tried desperately to save them, along with his younger brother and other family members. Finally, in one rare success story in this tragedy, the boy was pulled alive yesterday afternoon, conscious, calm and apparently unscathed. What position did they find him in? A journalist asked his older cousin, Salman Al-Farisi. He was in his bedroom, watching TV with his mother, he said. But it's unclear if his mother is still alive. Some reports say only his grandfather and brother survived with him, and two others died. The boy has now been taken to hospital, where many other survivors weren't so lucky. Many at Cianjur's main public hospital have severe head injuries, broken bones or limbs that have been crushed by falling buildings. I was hit on my head. I've had stitches at the front and back, says one woman, Dedi Nurfatona. My leg also has internal injuries. Everyone here has a tragic story to tell. I heard a faint call for help from inside our collapsed house. I'm here, says the woman's husband at her bedside. I entered the house and found my wife under the concrete slab. I lifted it to free her, but gave her to a policeman because I was also hurt. Whether or not they're physically injured, many evacuees are emotionally traumatised and afraid to go back home. The hospital here is relying on volunteers to care for the huge number in need, says its head, Dr. Surya.
The hospitals are overcrowded, so we need to intervene and create this makeshift hospital. Otherwise, there will be many patients that will be neglected.
There are still more than 100 people missing, feared dead. Authorities are still bringing in more heavy machinery to clear the landslides. There have been more than 170 aftershocks, including one of magnitude 3.9 yesterday, that police say triggered another landslide. This is Anne Barker in Cianjur, reporting for AM.
The Reconciliation Barometer, published every 2 years, is out painting an interesting picture of the relationships between First Nation Australians and the wider community. It shows trust's improving, that public support for a treaty between First Nations people and the government is at an all-time high, but Indigenous people are increasingly experiencing racism and prejudice, and many Australians still don't acknowledge the truth of colonial history. Political reporter Dana Morse has more.
Taking the temperature of relationships between First Nations people and the broader Australian community is a big part of moving reconciliation forward.
We run it every 2 years just so we get a picture, a snapshot of what's going on at that moment.
That's Karen Mundine, a Budgerlung woman and chief executive of Reconciliation Australia, the peak body behind the barometer report. It details the attitudes and experiences of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people across five key areas: race relations, equality and equity, unity, institutional integrity and acceptance of history.
When we think about reconciliation, the other part that's really important of that is good relationships are built on trust. We've got some pretty good solid ground there. 63% of both populations think that they are likely to have trust for the other population, whether even if they don't know them, even if they don't have any relationship or engagement with them.
And with so many conversations about voice, treaty and truth happening across the country, signs are looking good for a referendum, with more than 80% of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people in support of a representative body. Special Envoy for Reconciliation and the Uluru Statement, Senator Pat Dodson, says that's a heartening response.
We are moving as a nation, and I think that's a positive thing. We're at a stage where we should never take for granted anyone's support, but we need to work out the things that the barometer has indicated to us. Greater interaction between ourselves, learning about each other, building up the trust between us, building up the opportunities to meet and mix with each other, and a better understanding of our own mutual perspectives.
But on the flip side, more First Nations people are experiencing racism and prejudice. Almost two-thirds of Indigenous Australians have experienced at least one form of racial prejudice in the past 6 months.
So when we look at the overall rise of racism or experiences of racism, it suggests a couple of things to us. It's interpersonal, but also, and we know this anecdotally, it seems that rise in online abuse and racism.
42% of the general population and 57% of Indigenous people think Australia is a racist country. Professor Chelsea Watego is a Mununjali and South Sea Islander woman and a leading researcher on race and racism.
While it is alarming, it is also an underestimation of the reality of racism in Australian society.
Professor Watego says the denial of colonial history feeds directly into racism today.
I find it surprising that we're still asking people whether they believe that frontier violence existed, that children were removed from their families systematically. That tells us something. It has a very terminologous vibe. You know, once upon a time we were having to prove our existence in this place, and still we're trying to prove that what was done to us actually happened.
Pat Dodson says Australians need to understand where their racism comes from.
We've got to help people understand what gives rise to their racism, and not just call them racist, because I think if they start to understand why they behave in a certain way, and that's usually because they think someone's getting something better or getting something more or being given greater status. Well, none of that's true, but it's irrationality, and irrational things spread like wildfire in this country and gives rise to ignorance and bigotry.
He thinks the true test of reconciliation will come when the referendum is held.
I don't see anything to fear from the referendum. It can only augur well for us as a nation and augur well for the First Nations peoples of this country.
A special envoy for reconciliation and the Uluru Statement, Senator Pat Dodson, ending that report by Dana Morse. Will Kanya in New South Wales's far west hit world headlines last year during the COVID pandemic? Overcrowding, poorly maintained homes and health services in the mainly Indigenous community were frequently mentioned. The state's housing office has just unveiled several new units, which it's hoped will be the first steps in solving the town's housing problem. With more, here's Bill Orman.
On what would usually be a quiet street in Wilcannia, the final touches are being made to five brand new social housing units. Construction worker Earl Dutton is one of almost two dozen local Indigenous people employed on the project. He says the new units designed for elders mean a lot to residents in the tiny, predominantly Indigenous community.
It's a big thing. It's a real big thing. I can't explain it.
The build also addresses one of the town's biggest issues, unemployment.
Some of the young fellas around here, they got nothing to do. Smoke yarn, you drink. But this is a good opportunity for the boys to come and work it, earn their own money.
It also addresses overcrowding, which was highlighted during the town's COVID outbreak last year. Upwards of 10 men, women and children were forced to isolate in the same home, many of whom didn't have the virus.
A lot of the elders, they still live in their houses that they've been living in for 30, 40, 50 years, and there's been a few generations grow up in them households, and now we're running out of space for all these newer generations.
That's Michael Kennedy, Barkindji man and chairperson of Wilcannia's local Aboriginal Land Council. He's grateful for the investment and support received from the Aboriginal Housing Office to tackle overcrowding.
Elders are a big, big part of our life, mate. We need our elders around us, you know. They're our backbones in our communities. We got people that use their land room as their bedrooms for quite a number of years.
Gethable woman Fami Williams is the chief executive of the AHO. She says the project began back in 2017 when the community approached her organisation to rejuvenate the old police barracks, which had remained largely untouched for years.
It keeps that skill within community. It provides opportunities for people to develop those skills and also apply them to other projects in their community. And I think also there's a sense of pride, you know, when you're building a property that you know is going to house your family, I think that really goes a long way to creating a good sense of pride across the community.
And while the project is a step in the right direction towards solving the issue of overcrowding, there's still a long way to go, according to locals.
It's not going to solve all the problems. We still need probably small homes, units, for a lot of the young ones. There's a lot of young ones now that have got one or two children or just a young couple living together now, so it'd be nice to put them in some space as well, you know.
Barkindji man and Wilcannia Aboriginal Local Land Council chairperson Michael Kennedy ending that report from Bill Ormond. Nurse practitioners are increasingly filling the gaps created by a shortage of doctors in regional Australia, but it's reaching crisis point with some communities now paying for the services themselves. Nurses believe a more viable solution would be increasing the Medicare rebates they're paid. From Westonia in the West Australian Wheat Belt, Bridget Herman reports.
I'm just going to check your blood pressure.
Okay.
See how that's going.
When there's no doctor in Westonia, a rural town more than 300 kilometres east of Perth, nurse practitioner Laura Black looks after the health of locals. But she says government funding for her role is only guaranteed until December, leaving an unviable future.
So in my role as a nurse practitioner, to rely on the Medicare rebates for funding my role is not an option.
Shire Councillor Karen Day says the town of 250 residents is looking at different ways to fund the role, including creating a future salary fund.
We're asking clients to pay $20 for a visit when they see Laura. We'd love to think that this could be a self-supporting service, but I don't believe it will be.
Further north in the Pilbara, a charity health clinic gave up its nurse practitioners due to funding cuts. Karratha Central Healthcare Chief Executive Beverly Menezes says she's trying to figure out how she can source funding to bring them back.
Once we have a viable pilot ready to roll out, we'll be seeking support not only from all levels of government, but also main players in industry and other major employers in the Pilbara. We see this as a great attraction and retention mechanism for everybody who lives and works here.
The Australian College of Nurse Practitioners West Australian Chairman, Adam McCavery, says the industry has asked for a rise in the Medicare rebates.
We would absolutely love to see parity to GPs, but we've been realistic in our submission that we've made to the federal government and asked for a fair rise so that we are given appropriate remuneration for the time we spent with our patients.
Royal Australian College of GPs West Australian Chair Dr. Ramya Rahman says healthcare funding is a broader issue.
It's been shown that investing in primary healthcare and particularly in general practice actually enables a stronger healthcare and reduces hospital admissions and readmissions for patients. With regards to Medicare rebates, we're calling for that in general practice as well.
The Federal Health Department says the government is considering Medicare rebate changes for nurse practitioners as part of a 10-year plan. The Albanese government has also announced it aims to fill workforce shortages by wiping the university debts of doctors and nurse practitioners who work for extended periods in rural and remote areas.
Bridget Herman reporting, that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The World Cup is underway in Qatar, and while it won't stop billions of people tuning in, it's never had such a contentious start. Today, host of the Ticket podcast, Tracy Holmes, on corruption, bribery and human rights abuses, and why she thinks the Arab nation has been judged too harshly. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.